thick variables, which alternately brightened and dimmed on their own, while Sergei looked at stars that repeatedly hid some or all of their light behind a partner. He had a nose for picking out surprising star pairs. For example, he showed that the giant star VV Cepheid not only varied its light in typical Cepheid fashion, but also was partially eclipsed every 20 years by a small companion. No one else had noticed that extra bit of variation in its pattern. Shapley applauded Sergei for being so surprisingly lucky or instinctively guided that he can pull down such unusual eclipsing stars. Gaposchkin, by his own description, did not so much pull them down as go fishing for stars in the ocean of glass plates. At the 1943 winter meeting of the American Astronomical Society, held in Cincinnati, the Executive Council moved to award the fourth Annie Jump Cannon Prize to Miss Cannon's old friend and co-worker, Antonia Maury. The 77-year-old Miss Maury, a party to the discovery of spectroscopic binaries in 1889, had nurtured her interest in those stars through all the intervening years. She had also followed her pet variable, the strange Beta Lyrae, through hundreds of Harvard spectrograms taken over decades. She saw her account of the spectral changes of Beta Lyrae published in the Harvard Annals in 1933, 2 years before her retirement. But even now, she continued visiting the observatory to review any new plates that included Beta Lyrae, whose behavior remained an enigma. Miss Maury's aunt, Antonia Draper Dixon, died in 1923, leaving her niece the diamond ring that had once belonged to Anna Palmer Draper. The family property at Hastings-on-Hudson became a trusteeship of the American Scenic Historic Preservation Society. Miss Maury, who lived in the old observatory cottage built for her grandfather, wanted to turn part of the 10-acre tract into a botanical garden. She invited neighborhood children to wander freely about the grounds of Draper Park, or accompany her on walks to learn the names of all the plants, birds, insects, and rocks that she had come to love in her own childhood. With guidance from Shapley, she purchased a second-hand Alvin Clark 6-inch telescope, not just for her personal use, but as an attraction for local residents, whom she would also treat to free public lectures in her areas of expertise. Members of the Hastings Amateur Astronomy Association laid a cement platform for the telescope in 1932, and a committee from the mayor's office raised funds for a shed to protect it. But the shed was never finished, and Miss Maury's grand design failed to materialize. Recently, Miss Maury had taken up the cause of the western redwood forests. The wartime demand for lumber was feeding these trees to sawmills with no thought of their conservation, and she meant to alter the situation if possible. She spoke of it to Mrs. Gaposchkin, whom she regarded as the daughter she wished were hers, and who shared her appreciation of botany. Mostly they spoke of stars and spectra, but of enough other things besides to make Mrs. Gaposchkin describe Miss Maury as a dreamer and a poet, always vehemently denouncing injustice, forever battling for a good, often a lost cause. Miss Maury's original stellar classification scheme received new recognition in 1943, when astronomers at the Yerkes Observatory proposed refinements to the Henry Draper catalog. The new MKK system, so named for William Morgan, Philip Keenan, and Edith Kelman, preserved Miss Cannon's letter categories in the accustomed order, and also the numbered subscripts, 0 to 9, which graded intermediate spectral identities. The major innovation of the MKK system was the addition of Roman numerals 1 through 5 to designate each star's luminosity, or intrinsic brightness, the very quality that Miss Maury had attempted to characterize by her A, B, and C divisions. Morgan himself expressed the highest regard for Miss Maury, whom he considered an even more skilled stellar classifier than the late Miss Cannon. The Memorial Annals volume to be dedicated to Miss Cannon stalled during the war for lack of funds and personnel. By 1944, the number of observatory staff engaged in full-time war-related work had risen from 25 to 32. Meanwhile, good weather continued to smile on Bloemfontein, where the quantity of glass plates in storage tested the available space. Shapley yearned to see the fruits of the latest 2 years' labors in the Southern Hemisphere. Given the fairly reliable delivery of mail and supplies from England to Africa, and a sudden drop in insurance rates for international shipments, he asked Dr. Paraskevopoulos to send home some of the plates. About 1,500 photographs, or 1/10 of the accumulation, joined other cargo loaded aboard the Robin Goodfellow, bound from Cape Town to New York. On July 25, 1944, the ship was torpedoed in the South Atlantic and sank with the loss of all hands. Everything looked different after the war, after the usual atrocities typical of armed conflict had been overshadowed by the summary annihilation of several hundred thousand human beings by a new class of weapon. People began to speak of science as having known sin. Even as Shapley anticipated the return of the observatory's former good fortune, he recoiled from what he had seen. Should we plan to construct large new buildings in urban areas in this age of atomic bombs? He asked in his 1946 report to President Conant. Should the staff of the observatory, with its experience and specialized knowledge, help in the creation of international scientific institutions as part of its contribution to international sanity? Should our experts in ballistics, rocket problems, optics, turn hopefully away from the wartime applications of science? Should we now work out a plan for burying our best photographs, records, and publications in such a way that they might be discovered and utilized in some later millennium, when less social stupidity prevails among the higher animals? Such comments, paired with the director's liberal politics and aid to displaced foreign scientists, drew suspicion from the House Un-American Activities Committee. Shapley was subpoenaed by the committee in November 1946 to appear at a closed hearing in Washington, but he suffered no penalties as a result of that encounter. Later, when Senator Joseph McCarthy accused him of ties to communist organizations, Shapley accused the senator of telling 6 lies in 4 sentences, which is probably the indoor record for mendacity. If the war had taught astronomers their fitness for national defense, it also taught the government the value of supporting certain areas of basic research in astronomy. The sun, for example, was now known to affect the stratum of Earth's atmosphere where radio transmissions traveled. A high-altitude station to monitor the sun's behavior at the Harvard Observatory, set up in 1941 near Climax, Colorado, became the darling of the Office of Naval Research. During the war, when large-scale military operations depended on radio communication, attacks had been scheduled on the sun's timetable. Advances in the new field of solar terrestrial relations offered direct benefits to post-war commercial shipping and aviation. At the Climax site, a peacetime Harvard project to photograph meteors was yielding much desired information on atmospheric temperature, density, and drag. Government agencies saw no gain, however, in probing the variable stars or the structure of the Milky Way and its place among the other galaxies. Shapley thus ran into difficulties resuscitating his own chosen areas of interest. He urgently needed to hire new computers, but the low salaries for those positions looked even lower after the war, when inflation drove up prices and new industries paid higher wages. Realizing the need for non-military agencies to bolster basic research, Shapley helped establish the National Science Foundation in the United States and also took part in the creation of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. In 1946, the Harvard administration reacted to Shapley's leftist political activities by restructuring the observatory hierarchy. Shapley retained the title of director, but ceded control to a new observatory council, which included Bart Bok, Donald Menzel, Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, and Fred Whipple, a meteor and comet expert on staff since 1931. Bok was promoted to full professor and associate director, with supervision of Oak Ridge. Menzel was named chairman of the astronomy department and associate director for solar work. Mrs. Gaposchkin retained her title of Phillips astronomer. Some of the former employees of the observatory were willing to come back to work after the war at their former low salaries. One of these, Ellen Dorrit Hofflight, returned in 1948 for the love of astronomy, at half her army pay. Dr. Hofflight, a 1928 graduate of Radcliffe, had moved into the observatory straight out of college. She started on variable stars, but soon switched to meteors and later to the determination of stellar brightness by the widths of spectral lines. Her wartime work had taken her from the MIT Radiation Laboratory to the Ballistic Research Laboratory of the Army's Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland, to the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. She had computed everything from firing tables for Navy cannons to the velocities of captured V-2 rockets. Now that she was once again sighting objects native to the sky, she availed herself of help from rented IBM computing equipment in analyzing data on stellar distribution. The days of the human computer were numbered by zeros and ones. Former Pickering Fellow Helen Sawyer Hogg took the news of her Annie Jump Cannon Prize not exactly in stride. Pleasure jostled with anxiety and the lethargy that had come over her in the past few months. "All spring, I have felt very doleful," she told Shapley in a letter dated July 25, 1949. She had seen him just recently at the June gathering of the American Astronomical Society in Ontario, where she now lived. "I left the Ottawa meetings more depressed than when I went, and the night observing, which I have been tackling systematically since my return, has served only to convince me once more that I cannot fit in night work with my heavy family responsibilities. In other words, I seem to have reached the end of my tether." Helen and her husband Frank, a native Canadian, had moved to Victoria, British Columbia in 1931 to work at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory. Only Frank had a job there, but Helen also worked full-time as a volunteer. She was the first woman allowed to use the 72-inch reflector. When the Hogg's daughter, Sally, was born in 1932, Helen continued her observing runs with Sally in a basket beside her. Sympathetic observatory director John Stanley Plaskett got Mrs. Hogg a $200 grant, so she could hire a housekeeper to mind the baby. In 1935, Frank was offered a professorship at his alma mater, the University of Toronto, and the family moved back east. Helen, too, was hired in Toronto. She became a research officer in the astronomy department and the university-affiliated David Dunlap Observatory in 1936, the year of David Hogg's birth. The Hoggs had another boy, James, in 1937, and Helen published her Catalog of 1,116 Variable Stars in Globular Clusters in 1939. The outbreak of war gave her the opportunity in 1941 to teach astronomy classes at the university, which she had continued ever since. "I have asked Frank to get me an indefinite leave of absence from my university position here, but he is very much upset at the thought. The Annie Jump Cannon prize seemed to add a new weight of obligation. In my opinion, this award carries with it a certain amount of responsibility, when made to a person at my age, that is. She was 44. In other words, it does not look so good to take the award and quit. Conflicted, she had not yet responded to the AAS secretary, C.M. Huffer, regarding her expected acceptance. It has probably not crossed his mind that circumstances might make it advisable for me to refuse the award. Shapley himself felt dispirited by his current distance from active research, but he was as capable as ever of heartening a former student, especially one who shared his long-term devotion to globular clusters. There is little doubt but that you are undertaking too much in running a family at this critical stage, he replied on July 29, 1949, and doing everything else. A leave of absence from the university work is obviously a good idea, but a study with astronomical literature in it and some photographs of clusters and the computing machine, that should not be given up, even if it must be established in one corner of some room at home. And also, probably, there is some interesting and not too laborious writing about old books that should be done, just to keep the finger in the game until strength and time are less expensive. Old books was her term for the historical astronomical catalogs and other texts that she discussed in her regular column, Out of Old Books, for the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. About that award, don't be silly, even if the weather is hot. The award is made for past accomplishments and carries with it no responsibility for future activities. Suppose I should commence turning in medals because I have degenerated into being just a blank-blank director, personality smoother, instigator of labors by others. Let's both cheer up. One particular reason for such a resolve is that after 15 or 20 lectures on cosmogony in the Harvard Summer School, I have convinced myself that this is unquestionably the best universe I know of. Shapley had introduced the graduate summer program in astronomy and astrophysics in 1935. It collapsed during the war, but roared back to life afterward, and currently enrolled more than a dozen students. Just as Pickering had made the observatory's name synonymous with photometry and photography, Shapley tied it securely to graduate education. He had fostered a generation of Harvard astronomers. Mrs. Hogg accepted her Annie Jump Cannon Prize at the June 1950 meeting of the AAS, held at the University of Indiana in Bloomington. Not long afterward, on New Year's Day, 1951, her husband, then the 46-year-old director of the David Dunlap Observatory, died of a heart attack. She assumed many of his professional duties, including the teaching of his courses and the writing of his weekly astronomy column for the Toronto Star, but not the directorship, which went to someone else. In August 1951, Shapley gave notice that he would retire as director of the Harvard Observatory at the end of one more year, shortly before his 67th birthday. To his chagrin, the university hesitated to name a successor, either from within the ranks or from another institution. Months passed in which the staff grew increasingly insecure. At the same time, the lack of a designated new leader diminished the observatory's standing in the eyes of prospective students and astronomers generally. In March 1952, President Conant appointed an ad hoc committee, chaired by his wartime colleague, J. Robert Oppenheimer, to evaluate the entire Harvard astronomy program. As Shapley prepared to vacate his position that August, Donald Menzel of the Observatory Council was named temporary acting director. Menzel shepherded the observatory through the ensuing period of upheaval. The next 2 years saw the demolition of the old wooden structures, the erection of brick office buildings alongside the Great Refractor, The eviction of the American Association of Variable Star Observers from the observatory grounds, and the abandonment of the Boyden Station in South Africa. Menzel was officially named the sixth director in January 1954, and in 1955, the Harvard College Observatory formed a beneficial new association with the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, which moved from Washington, D.C. to Cambridge. At the Oak Ridge site, renamed the Agassiz Station in memory of patron George R. Agassiz, a large new telescope marked Harvard's entry into the emerging science of radio astronomy. Where a 60-inch optical reflector had once been dominant, an antenna 60 feet in diameter now collected faint radio signals from deep space. Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin became a full professor in 1956, the first woman at Harvard to be promoted to that level. She sent handwritten invitations to all the female astronomy students to join her for a celebration in the observatory library, where she pulled herself up to her full height, squared her broad shoulders, and said with a twinkle, "I find myself cast in the unlikely role of a thin wedge." As full professor, she was eligible to become department chairman, which title was thrust on her the following fall. Although she had long craved the prestige of that position, the cares of office alternately bored her and strained her nerves. What was worse, they took time away from her research. In 1958, the Harvard Corporation, under President Nathan M. Pusey, at last elected Celia Payne Gaposchkin, the Phillips Professor of Astronomy. Even then, her salary of $14,000 a year, while higher than her husband's, remained far below that of her male peers. Catherine Wolfe Bruce's investment in astronomy came too late in life to answer her questions about the universe. The medal she endowed, however, continues today to attach her name to every significant advance in her adopted science. Among the more than 100 Bruce Gold medalists who have been celebrated for their lifetime achievements, Arthur Stanley Eddington deciphered the internal structure of the stars, realizing that their mass at the time of their birth determines their ultimate fate. Henry Norris Russell charted the course of stellar evolution, showing that stars do change from one color to another as they age. And Hans Bethe explicated the process of nuclear fusion by which stars generate their heat and light. In addition to Edward Pickering, Harvard College Observatory winners of the Bruce Medal include Harlow Shapley, Bart Bok, and Fred Whipple, who propounded the dirty snowball model of comet construction. To date, only four women have received the Bruce Medal. The first, in 1982, was Margaret Peachy Burbidge, a native of England who studied the spectra of galaxies and, in collaboration with her husband, Geoffrey, and their colleagues William Fowler and Fred Hoyle, showed that all heavy elements are produced in the interiors of stars. In 1990, the Bruce Medal went to Charlotte Moore Sidderley. As Princeton computer Charlotte Moore in 1929, she took advantage of Henry Norris Russell's absence on sabbatical to enroll at the University of California, Berkeley, where she earned her PhD in 1931, doing research on the spectra of sunspots. After she returned to Princeton and married astronomer Bancroft Sidderley in 1937, she continued working and later became manager of the program in atomic spectroscopy at the National Bureau of Standards. Vera Rubin, who attended Vassar College because of its historic association with Mariah Mitchell, received the 2003 Bruce Medal for her measurements of galaxy rotation, which led to the discovery of dark matter. Sandra Moore Faber, the 2012 winner, did her graduate work at Harvard, but has spent her career at the University of California observatories, pursuing the formation, structure, and clustering of galaxies. In 2013, she was one of 12 recipients of the National Medal of Science. The telescope named for Miss Bruce, which Shapley praised as the great galaxy hunter of the Southern Hemisphere, was decommissioned in 1950. It gave up its mount at Bloemfontein to a new 30-inch instrument that promised to provide even better photographs in shorter exposure times. The intact Bruce lens and tube stood idle for several years in Africa before being shipped back to the States for continued idleness at Oak Ridge. The Bruce's old dome in Arequipa was converted to a chapel. Miss Bruce herself lies buried, as she prearranged, at Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York, the final resting place of the city's wealthiest, most prominent citizens of her day. Dr. and Mrs. Henry Draper are also buried there, together, under a joint pentagonal marker with a carved facsimile of the Congressional Medal, commending Dr. Draper's part in the 1874 transit of Venus. The Draper Medal, like the Bruce Medal, continues to acknowledge astronomers for lifelong accomplishments. Those researchers who have won both the Draper and the Bruce include Edward Pickering, George Ellery Hale, Arthur Stanley Eddington, Harlow Shapley, and Hans Bethe. No women have ever taken both prizes. In the years since Miss Cannon was awarded the Draper Medal, only one other woman has received it: radio astronomer Martha P. Haynes of Cornell University, who shared the 1989 honor with Riccardo Giovanelli for their joint mapping of the large-scale distribution of galaxies. The Annie Jump Cannon Prize likewise endures. It was awarded to Miss Cannon's former recorder, Margaret Walton Mayall, in 1958, and to Nantucket Observatory director Margaret Harwood in 1961. The frequency of selection has increased since 2006, when the American Astronomical Society began choosing a new winner every year. The annual cash award now exceeds $1,000, the amount originally contributed by Miss Cannon, but is no longer accompanied by a handmade pendant. In 2016, Laura A. Lopez of Ohio State University won the Cannon Prize for her studies in radio and X-ray astronomy regarding the life cycles of stars. On Observatory Hill in Cambridge, Massachusetts today, the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics stands as the successful union of the former Harvard and Smithsonian observatories. The CFA employs 300 scientists engaged in university and government-supported research covering every area of astronomy. Approximately one-third of the staff is female. The monumental work of stellar classification known as the Henry Draper Catalog and Extension, begun under Wilhelmina Fleming in the 1880s and continued through 1940 by Annie Jump Cannon, is still in regular use. Every astronomy student learns the temperature order of the stars by memorizing, "Oh, be a fine girl / guy, kiss me." A contest to come up with a cleverer, less sexist mnemonic was held for several years in Harvard's introductory astronomy course, but the anonymous original retains its utility and pride of place. The thousands of Henry Draper identification numbers, assigned to the stars by the female computers, remain in effect as well. Star number HD209458, for example, a variable in the constellation Pegasus, made news when modern detection methods located a planet in orbit around it. Antonia Mori's classification system, with its 22 spectral types and several subtypes, struck her contemporaries as too complex to gain traction. Some of its distinctions proved crucial, however, in discerning the different magnitudes and ages of stars that shared the same general categories. After Einar Hertzsprung first complimented Miss Morey's acumen in 1908, the Draper classification made room for one of her notations in 1922, and in 1943, the MKK innovation incorporated additional Morey-type gradations. In 1978, some 25 years after her death, her system won further vindication when William Morgan published the revised MK Spectral Atlas for stars earlier than the Sun, with new co-authors Helmut Opt and J.W. Tapscott. Morgan dedicated this volume to Antonia C. Maury, 1866 to 1952, master morphologist of stellar spectra. Henrietta Leavitt did not participate in the classification effort, but her pursuit of variable stars and her discovery of the relationship between period and brightness among the Cepheid variables has had an equal, if not greater, impact on progress in astronomy. Once calibrated and applied to the problem of measuring distances across space, Miss Leavitt's period-luminosity relation allowed Harlow Shapley to extend the boundaries of the Milky Way. The same Cepheid stars, subjected to the same analytical techniques, enabled Edwin Hubble to appreciate the enormous distances to the spiral nebulae. Hubble used Cepheids in 1924 to show that the Milky Way was not the only galaxy in the universe, and later to demonstrate that the universe was expanding to ever vaster proportions, as evidenced by the speedy outbound flight of most external galaxies. The Cepheids, however, had still more to say about cosmic distances. During World War II, Walter Bade, a German immigrant who had been working at Mount Wilson since 1931, took advantage of dark skies made darker by area-wide blackouts. Bade's detailed study of the stars of the Andromeda Galaxy split the Cepheids into two subgroups. He accordingly recalibrated the distance scale and arrived at an overall size of the universe that doubled Hubble's estimate. Today, astronomers rely on the period luminosity relation to measure the current expansion rate of the universe. The relationship between redshift and distance that Hubble saw in the realm of the nebulae has come to be known as Hubble's law. By the same token, some scientists argue, the relationship between period and brightness that provided the basis for Hubble's discoveries should rightly be named the Leavitt law. Awareness of this proposed terminology has been spreading since January 2009, when the Executive Council of the American Astronomical Society unanimously passed a resolution in favor of the change. The occasion was the 100th anniversary of Henrietta Leavitt's first presentation of the Cepheid period luminosity relation, a seminal discovery in astronomy that continues to have great significance. Although the counselors allowed that the AAS had no authority to define astronomical nomenclature, they said that they personally would be very pleased to see the designation Leavitt Law in wide use. When the female computers of the Harvard College Observatory come up in present-day conversation, they are often portrayed as underpaid, undervalued victims of a factory system. Pickering stands accused of giving them scut work that no man would stoop to do. Yet this is far from true. Before astronomy morphed into astrophysics around the turn of the 20th century, both men and the few women engaged in the science were willing slaves to routine. Arthur Searle, the acting director during the interregnum between Winlock and Pickering, tried to explain this reality to a journalist intent on chronicling the excitement of observatory life. "It is only fair to warn you," Searle admonished Thomas Kerwin of the Boston Herald, "that your proposed article cannot be at once true and entertaining. The work of an astronomer is as dull as that of a bookkeeper, which it closely resembles. Even the results reached by astronomical work, although they relate to more significant subjects than the ordinary affairs of trade, are far less interesting than the result of bookkeeping, at least to the general reader, unless they are so disguised by fancy as to have little to do with science." Pickering, though enthralled by the incremental gains he could make nightly at the controls of his photometer, ushered in a new era of photography and spectroscopy that transformed the observatory. Having found several female assistants already in place when he took charge, he brought in more of them and entrusted the stellar classification to their judgment. He also attracted assistants in variable star observation from alumni and female professors of the women's colleges. His treatment of women, widely perceived as more than fair, invited fellowship funding that further advanced women's participation in astronomy. When Harlow Shapley came to Harvard, he was able to redirect the fellowship money into a program of graduate education that initially and necessarily favored women over men as applicants. Cecilia Payne's attainment of the first astronomy PhD at Harvard, in the course of which she challenged the very fabric of the universe, could be traced directly to Pickering's harem and the observatory's singular collection of glass plates. No astronomer working today uses glass plates to photograph the cosmos. CCDs, or charge-coupled devices, began replacing photographic film in the 1970s. And for the past two decades, virtually all celestial images have been captured and stored digitally. But no matter how broadly or deeply modern sky surveys probe outer space, they cannot see what the heavens looked like on any given date between 1885 and 1992. The record preserved in the Harvard Plate Collection of 100 years of starry nights remains unique, invaluable, and irreplaceable. The 500,000 glass plates reside in the expanded brick building. They stand on their long edges, leaning slightly to the left or right on the shelves of the many metal cabinets. Some early photographs still wear their original paper jackets, covered over with handwritten commentary from their long-ago keepers. Old or new, each envelope bears an affixed barcoded sticker containing accession information that helps the current curator maintain order in the plate stacks. Visiting researchers file in and out. Historians prize the plates for their dated information, for the antiquated union of glass and silver gelatin emulsion that embeds the stars. Astrophysicists consult the plates to enrich and interpret the latest findings through time-domain astronomy. Celestial denizens undreamed of at the start of Pickering's Sky Patrol. Pulsars, quasars, black holes, supernovae, X-ray binaries, nevertheless left their marks on the plates. When computers were human, they scanned these photographs by eye for as many interesting objects as they could find. There were never enough readers to utilize the plate library to Pickering's or Shapley's satisfaction. The most motivated of their methodical workers, when confronted with an image containing as many as 100,000 stars, could carry discovery only so far. Even now, the information content of the plate stacks is largely untapped. To extract all that waiting data with modern computerized algorithms, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics inaugurated a digitization project in 2005 with funding from the National Science Foundation. The ongoing goal is to clean, scan, and analyze every plate so as to provide digital access to a Sky Century at Harvard, or DASC at H. After more than 10 years, the work is approximately one quarter complete. All procedures and instruments for DASC at H have had to be invented and assembled on site. From the dishwasher-like machine that cleans the plates, to the custom-built high-speed scanner that accommodates the standard 8x10, and also the Bruce size 14x17 plates. At each stage of activity, curatorial concerns vie with scientific requirements. For example, the plate cleaning process, an essential prelude to producing clear, crisp scans, automatically erases any markings jotted on the glass by iconic figures such as Henrietta Leavitt and Annie Cannon. The compromise solution is to photograph each marked photograph before cleaning it, and each jacket, too, to record all those notations. Certain plates are judged too historic to be tampered with and will be archived indefinitely. One of these holds an image of a star field made while the nature of spiral nebulae still sparked debate. On it, someone circled a tiny swirl of matter too small to see without a magnifying loop. Next to the inked circle, an inked question arises. Galaxy? The index cards and logbooks that list the telescope, sky coordinates, date, and exposure time of each photograph are also coming online, thanks to willing individuals who spend a few hours every day transcribing them via the Smithsonian Institution's crowdsourcing platform. Citizen scientists work in front of their own computer screens, from high-resolution photographs of each logbook's 100 pages, each page crammed with statistics and remarks on as many as 20 plates. At the outset, DASH team members named reasons beyond data mining as justification for their long-term project. They wanted to make the plates available for convenient worldwide use, to protect them from careless handling by interested borrowers, and to save the contents from predictable deterioration, such as emulsion separation. Once the process was underway, an unanticipated event provided further justification for the effort. On Monday morning, January 18, 2016, a water main burst under a courtyard at 60 Garden Street, the official address of the CFA. The pipe provided water to four nearby buildings, including the original brick building and its 1902 and 1931 extensions. The rupture released water underground with enough force to breach the foundation walls and flood the lower level of the plate vault. Approximately 61,000 plates were submerged. Experts from the on-campus Weissman Preservation Center responded to the emergency and diagnosed mold as the worst-case outcome of immersion. Spores that colonized the plates might configure their own new biological constellations. For all of Pickering's foresight in initiating and protecting the collection, he never suspected that water, not fire, would threaten its integrity. The conservators prescribed the immediate removal of the plates to a dry place where they could be kept below 0 degrees centigrade, too cold for mold to grow. The prevailing weather conditions at the time, clear with temperatures below freezing, turned the outdoors into a temporary safe haven. Dozens of volunteers came to the collection's aid. They traipsed in and out of the stacks all through Monday night and Tuesday, carrying armloads of fragile plates to dry ground. Not a single piece of glass was broken. By Wednesday, the rescued plates had been driven in trucks to the Polygon Document Restoration Services in North Andover, where they were vacuum freeze-dried to be later thawed out and cleaned, one by one. One by one. The way the stars emerge as evening falls, the drowned, muddied plates will revive the vivid skyscapes that impressed them when they were sensitive to light. Once again, they will reveal the stellar spectra, the variable stars, the star clusters, the spiral galaxies, and all the other luminous sights they first conveyed to a small but dedicated circle of women. Sources. Chapter 1, Mrs. Draper's Intent. The letters between Anna Palmer Draper and Edward Pickering are held in the Harvard University archives, along with all the other observatory correspondence, and are quoted here with permission. Pickering's call for women assistance in the observation of variable stars was announced in the statement of work done at the Harvard College Observatory during the years 1877 to 1882, and was also issued as a separate brochure, a plan for securing observations of the variable stars. Hard copies of all the observatory publications, such as the annals and the annual reports, are held in the John G. Woolbach Library at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge. Most of these materials have been digitized and can be read online at http://adsabs.harvard.edu/historical.html. Chapter 2. What Miss Morey Saw. The letters of Antonia Morey to her Draper relatives are held in the Library of Congress and excerpted here with the permission of her family. All correspondence concerning the Boyden Station of the Harvard College Observatory is held in the Harvard University Archives. Chapter 3. Miss Bruce's Largesse. Letters to Edward Pickering from Catherine Wolfe Bruce, as well as those from her sister Matilda, are held in the Harvard University Archives. The article by astronomer Simon Newcomb that galvanized Miss Bruce was titled "The Place of Astronomy Among the Sciences." It appeared in 1888 in the Sidereal Messenger. Wilhelmina Fleming's prepared speech for the Chicago conference was published as "A Field for Woman's Work in Astronomy" in 1893 in Astronomy and Astrophysics. Chapter 4. Stella Nova. Edward Pickering reported Mrs. Fleming's first nova discovery, a new star in Norma, in the pages of Astronomy and Astrophysics. Pickering's correspondence with Antonia Morey, also with the Reverend Mitten Morey, is held in the Harvard University Archives. Chapter 5. Bailey's Pictures from Peru. Annie Jump Cannon was a lifelong diarist and prolific letter writer. Her diaries, scrapbooks, and other papers, including the libretti she collected for the many opera performances she attended, are held in the Harvard University Archives. Antonia Morey's Verses to the Vassar Dome, written in 1896, were printed in Popular Astronomy in 1923. Edmund Halley summoned astronomers to observe the transit of Venus with his announcement, in Latin, of "A New Method of Determining the Parallax of the Sun," published in Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society in 1716. Chapter 6. Mrs. Fleming's Title. The handwritten journal of Wilhelmina Patton Fleming, part of the Harvard Chest of 1900, is held in the University Archives and can be read online at http://pds.lib.harvard.edu/pds/view/3007384. President Edward B. Noble's comments pertaining to the presentation of Edward Pickering's second gold medal were published in Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society in February 1901. Chapter 7. Pickering's Harem. The correspondence between Andrew Carnegie and Edward Pickering, also the letters exchanged by Louise Carnegie and Wilhelmina Fleming, are held in the Harvard University Archives. Chapter 8. Lingua Franca. Herbert Hall Turner commented on the marvelous achievements of Wilhelmina Fleming in the obituary he wrote for her, which was published in Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1911. Edward Pickering's diary of his trip to Pasadena to attend the 1910 meeting of the Solar Union is held in the Harvard University Archives and was transcribed for publication in Southern California Quarterly by historian Howard Plotkin. Chapter 9. Miss Leavitt's Relationship. Frank Schlesinger of the Allegheny Observatory collated the responses of all the astronomers polled after the 1910 meeting in Pasadena and published their comments in the Astrophysical Journal under the heading "Correspondence Concerning the Classification of Stellar Spectra." Chapter 10. The Pickering Fellows. Harlow Shapley reminisced about his life experiences in a breezy memoir called Through Rugged Ways to the Stars, published in 1969. He dedicated the book to the memory of Henry Norris Russell. Margaret Harwood's letters to Annie Jump Cannon, Edward Pickering, and Harlow Shapley are preserved in the Harvard University archives, along with other materials pertaining to the observatory. But most of her private papers and photographs are held at the Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, Cambridge. Chapter 11, Shapley's Killigirl Hours. As chairman of the Astronomical Fellowship Committee, Annie Jump Cannon chronicled the activities of current and past Pickering Fellows in her write-ups for the Nantucket Mariah Mitchell Association annual report. These can be read online, courtesy of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory /NASA Astrophysics Data System at http://www.adsabs.harvard.edu. Chapter 12, Miss Payne's Thesis. Cecilia Payne recounted her life experiences in a treatise she named The Dyer's Hand. It was published in 1984, along with admiring essays by several of her colleagues, in Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, An Autobiography and Other Recollections, edited by her daughter, Catherine Haramundanis. Chapter 13, The Observatory Pinafore. Helen Sawyer Hogg recalled the events that shaped her astronomy career when she spoke at a commemorative symposium held August 25th through 29th, 1986, in Cambridge. The proceedings were later published as a book, The Harlow Shapley Symposium on Globular Cluster Systems and Galaxies, edited by Jonathan E. Grindley and A.G. Davis Phillip. The proceedings of another symposium, organized in 2000 to mark the 100th anniversary of Cecilia Payne's birth, were published in The Starry Universe, The Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin Centenary, edited by A.G. Davis Phillip and Rebecca A. Koopman. This volume includes lyrics sung by Josephine and other characters from The Observatory Pinafore. Chapter 14, Miss Cannon's Prize. The comments of Radcliffe Dean Bernice Brown and Astronomer Royal Sir Frank Dyson at the opening of the 1932 IAU General Assembly were published in Transactions of the International Astronomical Union, Volume 4. Chapter 15, The Lifetimes of Stars. The American Astronomical Society Executive Council's resolution regarding recognition of Henrietta Leavitt, including the officer's wish to see the Cepheid period luminosity relation renamed the Leavitt Law, was published in the AAS newsletter for May-June 2009. The new term originated in 2008, during a conference held at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics to celebrate the centenary of Miss Leavitt's discovery. Information about the conference, with links to all the presentations, can be found at https://www.cfa.harvard.edu/events/2008/Leavitt. Some highlights in the history of the Harvard College Observatory. 1839. Observatory established by Harvard Corporation at Dana House. William Cranch Bond appointed astronomical observer. 1843. Great Comet's visit inspires citizens of Boston and environs to fund the purchase of a large telescope for the observatory. 1844. Observatory moves to Summerhouse Hill, where a suitable foundation is laid for the new 15-inch telescope. 1845. First Harvard College Observatory Visiting Committee is headed by John Quincy Adams. 1846. George Phillips Bond appointed assistant observer. First annual report issued. 1847. The Great Refractor, a 15-inch telescope with a lens crafted in Munich, is mounted in the new observatory building. 1848. The Bonds discover the eighth moon of Saturn and name it Hyperion. Edward Bromfield Phillips bequeaths $100,000 to the observatory to pay salaries and all operating expenses. 1849. Statutes make the observatory a department of the university and change the elder Bond's title to director. 1850. First photograph of a star, Vega, taken by George Phillips Bond and John Adams Whipple. Jenny Lind sees a meteor fireball through the great refractor. 1856. First volume of the Annals of the Astronomical Observatory at Harvard College published. 1859. At death of William Cranch Bond, George Phillips Bond becomes second director. 1866. Joseph Winlock appointed as third director. 1868. Arthur Searle joins staff as assistant. 1870. Meridian Circle, an instrument for ascertaining star positions, is built for Winlock in London and installed at Harvard. William Rogers takes charge of meridian observations for astrometry, star positions. 1875. At Joseph Winlock's death, his daughter Anna joins computing staff. Miss Rhoda G. Saunders is hired as the first female computer from outside the observatory family. 1876. Arthur Searle serves as interim director. 1877. Edward Charles Pickering takes office as fourth director, initiates his program of stellar photometry. 1879. Wilhelmina Fleming is hired as a maid in the Pickering household. Edward Pickering introduces the meridian photometer for judging the brightness of stars. 1880. Edward Pickering publishes his five-type classification of variable stars. 1881. Wilhelmina Fleming becomes a permanent member of the observatory staff. 1882. Edward Pickering and his brother William of MIT experiment with lenses for photographing the night sky. Director Pickering issues a call for volunteers, especially women, to observe variable stars and share their results with Harvard. 1883. Harvard Observatory becomes the designated dispenser of information regarding cometary and other discoveries made by observers anywhere and telegraphed to observatories everywhere. 1884. Results of first photometry study published in the Annals, Volume 14. Edward Pickering divides entire sky into 48 equal regions, known as the Harvard Standard Regions. 1885. Bache Fund grant provides the 8-inch telescope required for Pickering's program of nightly sky photography. Wilhelmina Fleming begins to measure and compute stellar magnitudes from photographs. 1886. Anna Palmer Draper provides funding for photography of stellar spectra, with the aim of realizing the unfulfilled dream of her late husband, Dr. Henry Draper. Edward Pickering receives the Gold Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society in recognition of the Harvard photometry. 1887. Harvard acquires the Boyden Fund to build a high-altitude observatory. William Pickering joins the observatory staff. Edward Pickering is named the Payne Professor of Practical Astronomy. Arthur Searle assumes the title of Phillips Professor. 1888. Antonia Maury joins the staff of Female Computers, begins to study the spectra of bright northern stars. 1889. Solon Bailey begins observations in Peru, aided by his wife, Ruth E. Poulter Bailey. Catherine Wolfe Bruce gives $50,000 for construction of a 24-inch astrophotographic telescope. Edward Pickering discovers the first spectroscopic binary, Antonio Mori finds the second one. 1890. The Draper Catalogue of Stellar Spectra is published in the Annals, Volume 27, with classifications made by Wilhelmina Fleming. Solon Bailey establishes Harvard's Boyden Station at Arequipa. 1891. William Pickering takes over in Arequipa as Boyden Station director. Arthur Searle begins teaching astronomy classes for women. 1893. Solon Bailey resumes charge of Boyden Station in Peru. Glass plates are moved to new fireproof brick building. Wilhelmina Fleming prepares A Field for Woman's Work in Astronomy for presentation at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. Discovers her first nova on plates from Arequipa. Bruce Telescope sees first light at Cambridge. 1895. Edward Pickering institutes the Harvard College Observatory Circular to describe news of the observatory, beginning with Wilhelmina Fleming's discovery of Nova Carinae, her second nova, from photographs taken at Arequipa. Her third such discovery, Nova Centaurus, follows a few months later. Henrietta Swan Leavitt volunteers at the observatory. Solon Bailey discovers many variables within certain star clusters of the southern hemisphere. 1896. Annie Jump Cannon joins the observatory as a research assistant, commences her study of the spectra of bright southern stars. Bruce Telescope arrives at Arequipa. 1897. Antonio Mori publishes The Spectra of Bright Stars in the Annals, Volume 28, and is acknowledged as the author on the title page. 1898. National Professional Organization of Astronomers, later named the Astronomical and Astrophysical Society of America, established at a meeting held at Harvard. Edward Pickering introduces Harvard College Observatory Bulletins to augment the telegraphic announcements with details sent by mail. 1899. Wilhelmina Fleming, given Harvard title as Curator of Astronomical Photographs. William Pickering discovers a ninth satellite of Saturn, Phoebe. 1900. Harvard Chest of 1900 Time Capsule Project invites Edward Pickering and Wilhelmina Fleming to chronicle their daily activities. Catherine Wolfe Bruce dies. 1901. Edward Pickering receives his second gold medal from the Royal Astronomical Society for variable star studies and advances in astrophotography. Annie Cannon publishes Catalog of Bright Southern Stars in the Annals, Volume 28. 1903. Annie Cannon publishes her Provisional Catalog of Variable Stars in the Annals, Volume 48. After an absence of several years, Henrietta Leavitt returns as a full-time employee. Edward Pickering issues Photographic Map of the Entire Sky. 1905. Henrietta Leavitt notices an inordinate number of variables in the Magellanic Clouds. Edward Pickering elected president of the Astronomical and Astrophysical Society of America. 1906. Edward Pickering and Henrietta Leavitt embark on a large-scale determination of photographic magnitudes. Wilhelmina Fleming elected to honorary membership.